Who let the dogs out?
Who let the dogs out?
Who let the dogs out?
It is time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine. 518-789-3440. MillertonVet.com. With us today, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, founder, co-owner, and chief vet of the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Hello, Dr. Cannon.
Greetings, Jill Goodman.
Greetings. I have questions. Do you have answers?
I hope that I have answers.
Well, we will start with...
Well, I always have answers. I hope they're good ones.
No, you always have answers. I agree, and they are usually very good and very useful. And I am becoming so analog at the moment that what I'm really interested in are, do you have a can opener kind of responses? So let's see what we can do.
I'll do my best with anti-digital.
Yes. Very, very. This begins the anti-digital series of Pet Files Ask the Vet, and kicked off with the Krause family in Copaic Lake. Warm weather, tall grass, upstate New York. So at the end of every day, we have to check our two yellow labs for ticks. Even though they're on Bravecto, we always end up having to pull off a tick or two, sometimes more. If we have to do that anyway, what's the point of the Bravecto? Why not just manually deal with it every day? And I'm going to just endorse that question because I'm having insecticide just brain issues, and I'm hoping for a good answer because I'm just deticking people here.
So, insecticide spraying issues? You mean in your?
In my mind, I'm having insecticide. When it suddenly dawned on me that basically I'm putting Raid on my dog once a month, or my pet, I was like, well, wait a second.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that there are problems, that it's a risk reward. It is.
I mean, it is a game of risk if you're not using anything to kill them after they bite, because the chances that you will miss one are pretty good. I usually pull off. When we go in the woods, we pull off, somewhere between 5 and 25 or 30 ticks off of our dogs, and they often crawl out. But despite doing that, I'm still finding usually one or two attached dead ones, or they're dead. You can tell that they're dead and flat in the fur. My dog's at Simparica Trio, actually. It's like Bravecto. I just switched from Bravecto to Simparica Trio, and it's the same thing. So we're giving a pesticide. Any way that you give the pesticide, it's the same. You're exposing your dog to a pesticide once a month. True. And it's all getting into the lipid layer of the skin. So they all work similarly. Some of them just work better than others. The dogs who are not on one of those things are the dogs who get Lyme disease. I rarely see the tick-borne diseases in dogs who, really rarely. Like, it doesn't even exist if you're fairly good about remembering to give one of the pesticides that works really well. So that would be a direct answer to that question. Why just not manually deal with it every day? Because you're not going to be perfect and your dog's going to be exposed. Now, that being said, not every dog comes down with symptoms of tick-borne disease. So as far as knowing what the risks are of using it, certainly, it's all
conjecture.
A philosophy,
yeah.
Whether you want to be exposed to that kind of thing or not. We are exposed to so many things. How can we minimize our exposure? And the exposure to the tick-borne diseases is pretty serious stuff as well.
Quick question about that. Would there be any benefit in the Krause family doing I don't even know the right words. Like some sort of like a Lyme titer or something, with
so
labs.
So and... Lyme Lyme testing? Yes.
Well, yeah, some pre thing, and then letting it go and seeing, you know, if they choose to, and then seeing what happens.
So the Lyme vaccine?
No, you mean?
Is that what you?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm thinking more of just the would there be any? I just remember, and this probably isn't helpful, but you know, every single one of my animals along the way has a very high some titer or something, and so we get it tested, and it turns out that they don't have Lyme disease. They have lots of antibodies or something.
Uh-huh.
And
so there is, you know, there is value in testing, and the dogs who are not on any preventive, we do recommend that you test them at least twice a year. So what we want to do is capture an increasing Lyme titer before you have symptoms, but that's not always possible. So some dogs have a really high titer and no symptoms at all, and it's really up in the air about whether that is important to treat or not. We are trying to be really good stewards of antibiotics as well.
Right.
So, you know, I know in the human world, the people who are real concerned about it are taking doxycycline a lot. They may only take it a couple of days, but they're taking because of ticket. So, you know, I guess which is the worst of the
wouldn't that come down more to the person's individual philosophy? It's like, okay, here's the thing. This is a this because everybody really does have to learn to do common sense. This isn't for you. This is for anybody who's listening who doesn't do this already. Hem. Common sense risk reward ratio, which is
certainly impossible
to do if you watch television or the news, because all you hear about is here's this for this, which is. But if for example, if the Krause family is more like the Goodman family here, and you know their labs are fine and they're pulling the ticks off, and they want to take a Bravecto break or something, then it's their call. Like, they could go and get a Lyme titer for their pups and see what happens.
I mean, that would be... Right. So you can absolutely do that, but most of the dogs will come down with symptoms of disease prior to testing. So if you're waiting 6 months, you know, unless you're testing once a week.
Okay.
Yeah, so lots of times they'll come down with the symptoms because if the tick is attached, so that's the problem, is you'll find them, you'll miss one or two, you find them attached, they are engorged, or you don't find them at all and they fall off. Mm-hmm. And so the problem nowadays is that so much of the population of ticks is infected with something that the rate of transmission is so high.
Gotcha.
So it used to be that you're going to have, you know, 10 tick bites before something is transmitted, but not anymore. It's like almost every tick is infected with something, and so your body might be able to overcome that, though. It's just that we can't predict who can and who can't.
Okay.
So, yeah, so, I mean, it is a risk, but I can't tell you I think in this area, with them being endemic, it's a pretty high risk. What's the risk of being chronically ill with Lyme disease? Again, Lyme disease is treatable in most cases. So, you know, your dog might not come down with symptoms. Your dog might come down with symptoms and be treatable. Your dog might end up with chronic Lyme. It's really hard to predict those, you know, which ones that's happening to. Some of these dogs are just over-medicated with so many things that I think they're more susceptible to disease, but other times it is a constitutional thing, you know, with what you're born with.
Yep.
Especially with dogs who are purebred.
It's true, but all good info, and the Krause family and the Goodman family, thank you. Jenna?
You're welcome.
Brooklyn, New York. Back in 2011, I lost my beloved Corgi Golden Retriever mix when his spleen became enlarged and inflamed. I was too sad to look into it at the time, but it's always bothered me that I never found out what could cause this issue. He was 12, ate a very high-quality diet, and seemed to be happy and healthy otherwise. Can you speak to some potential causes?
So the splenic enlargement and inflammation, I think, I think probably there was more to it than that. If Jenna lost her dog to this, maybe there was a tumor. So splenic tumors in golden retrievers, Labrador retrievers, golden retriever mixes, not uncommon. They have a genetic predisposition to certain cancers. Hemangiosarcoma is primary number one. And hemangiosarcoma of the spleen is very common. So this might be the issue. I'm not sure. Because an enlarged and inflamed spleen, of course, can be removed. You can live without your spleen. It does serve the function of helping your immune system and clearing out problematic cells in the blood. And so it would be not the greatest thing to lose your spleen, but you can live a normal life without your spleen. That being said, there must have been a tumor, I would guess, a cancer of some kind. And golden retrievers have a genetic predisposition to certain cancers. And
so it's not just something that it doesn't happen. There's a medical word for this, but I'm going to say unilateral. Spleens don't just, and in Chinese medicine, I'm kind of asking, it's just separately. Spleens don't tend to enlarge or inflame without some underlying activity.
Your spleen will get enlarged if you have, for instance, an immune-mediated blood disease like hemolytic anemia or thrombocytopenia, which is when the platelets or the red blood cells are being chewed up by your immune system. It's sort of autoimmune. People would think of it that way. And then the spleen can get very big, and those diseases are pretty treatable. So that wasn't mentioned here.
Right.
We all have genetic predispositions to something. And in part, it is the way that we take care of our bodies that can prevent the expression of those genes or enhance the expression of those genes. There's a whole body of science called nutrigenomics now that studies how nutrition affects your genes. And has branched out into how the genes affect how the body responds to food at the molecular level. So, you know, you can influence the risks that you have, definitely, the risk of developing certain diseases and of cancer by what you put in your body, by what you eat. And we know now, too, that you can eat certain foods that will help protect your genome or your genetic makeup from damage over time. So as we age, we get more free radical damage to our genes, and so changes to the genes that might predispose you to certain cancers.
Question,
so it's an interesting.
This is a cancer digression, but I am finding a lot of information now out there that I hadn't seen before about a parasitic link with cancer.
Parasitic?
Cancer being parasites or having some link to parasites. Have you seen any of that in your...
I have not. No, it's not something that has been in the science that I've been exposed to.
Okay.
So,
I thought that one of the last ones a long time ago. I'm going to go hunt and see because, as I said, the most recent thing that I saw seemed plausible. And so I think I sent it to, I actually sent it to you. So I'm going to see if I can find it again because I was quite curious about it.
Yeah, so I mean anything that invades the body in general, you know, is going to have the capability of changing your genome, I suppose. But, so for instance, intestinal and blood parasites have not been shown to predispose people to cancer, which is what we have the most information on, you know.
Right, I understand that, and it's turning, it looks like it's turning out that those cancers are actually parasitic, cancer itself. So we will talk about this further anon when we can do a plausibility check, not you, me, so that we're not... off on in the weeds,
yeah,
so to speak. But it just struck me because, as anyone who knows me knows, I tend to be long in the retriever or now spaniel department, and the genetic predisposition to that disease is interesting to me.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
But thank you. On behalf of Jenna, thank you. And we're moving on to Jonathan and Socrates. Could you explain sodium intake when it comes to dogs? How much is too much, and from what sources should they get it?
So sodium intake can be an issue, of course, because sodium tends to increase palatability, just like it does with people. So dogs will have more interest in eating things that are higher in sodium. It brings out the flavor of foods, and people tend to like to feed their pets things that they know that they're going to like. The dog treats can tend to be very high in sodium, and so you have to be careful about the number of treats that you're feeding in a day.
What about pepperoni, your favorite?
What about what?
Pepperoni, your favorite.
Pepperoni, right? Pepperoni's a bad one. Just like you can, you can see in your own diet, just compare, for instance, chicken broth, at the store. You can see some of the things have, and some of the miso broths too, and they'll have, you'll see a difference between 60 milligrams in a cup and 890 milligrams. So you have to watch what you're feeding. The lower quality dog foods tend to be higher in sodium in order to help increase palatability, because they don't need to put as much meat in. So dogs like the flavor and the smell of meat, even if it's dried, and they don't, they don't need to put as much in if they're increasing sodium. So if you're feeding a higher quality diet, higher quality often translates into the amount of money that you're spending, not always, but often does. And you want to be, I always counsel people to try to feed most of the treats as real food, real natural food. So if we're getting our sodium from fruits and vegetables and meat that occurs naturally, occurs in nature, and nothing's added to it, and it isn't processed, then that is probably the best food you can put in your body. It's the same thing for dogs. They like berries. Most dogs do, especially when they're puppies. You can get them to enjoy, some organic berries. You can get them to eat some pieces of organic carrot, raw carrot. Some of them even like vegetables. A little tiny piece of banana, something like that, is not going to be super high in sodium. But when we feed cheese, several pieces of cheese a day, hot dog pieces, be careful with your chicken broth or make it homemade. Those things can really increase the sodium. I don't think that I can give you an absolute amount of sodium to take in a day, but those are the guidelines.
No, that's good, and that's helpful. And, there has definitely been, let's just say my dad's generation thought nothing of throwing. I was actually thinking about this way back when. It's not sodium related per se, but my dad's generation thought nothing of tucking a pill or something in a slice of, or a handful of Lord knows what. I remember somebody with their liverwurst also, but and deli meats, which were incredibly high.
Yes, even the low sodium deli meats.
Scam.
Think about it as processed food. It's processed food. They're injecting it with gobs of sodium, even if it looks like a real sliced meat.
It's worse. I will tell you, in my view, my opinion only, the more diabolical is the handwritten sign that says natural flavor or something, because people just are completely hornswoggled by that, and they think, oh, I'm getting something good, and it's like, yeah, no, just because of the way that it's written or presented, should I say it's deceptive? If you don't know that natural flavoring is not the same thing as what it's supposed to taste like, then, and nobody tells you that.
They're not advertising the amount of sodium in those things. And so just it's a matter of educating yourself and thinking about, thinking about making your own real food. There's so much out there that you can just buy, which is so easy. And I've been known to do it myself, but the more you make at home, the more control you have about what goes into your food.
And the more control you have over what goes into your food, and that was the subpart of the other question is, like, years ago, like back in King Arthur's court, didn't they just put down what? I don't think they had kibble, did they?
Yeah, I don't think so.
No, I mean,
kibble
I think
came, kibble came about with World War One, I think, or World War II. I can't remember. World War One, maybe, and canned foods.
But prior, yeah. But prior to that, you just fed basically from the food chain seemed more chainy. In other words, you fed the scraps went down the line, and then you started again. So I'm going to try for another question, and this is from Morris in Germantown. I don't even know if I can pronounce this. Morris is fine, and Germantown's okay, but the rest of it, not so sure. There's an exchange that pops up a lot on Reddit, which goes like this. Person A, which brands of cat food don't contain gums, like guar gum or carrageenan?
Carrageenan.
Carrageenan. It's fun to say. Oh.
I believe that's how it's said.
Well, it is now. Carrageenan. Person B, gums aren't generally an allergen, so what's the problem? Personally, I sometimes get a mildly upset stomach from food that's got a lot of gums in it, but cats might be different. Do you have an opinion?
I do. I think most of the gums are used as emulsifiers, so they want to make something richer, creamier, you know, when you buy oat milk, which is popular now, you know, you'll find in the oat milks that are low fat, they put gums in them to promote that creamy feeling in your mouth, I guess. I don't know why they have to put it in cat food, but I think that it's all about appealing to the, you know, to the person who's buying it, not necessarily to the cat. So carrageenan comes from seaweed, actually, and is one of the nastier gums. It can cause, it certainly can cause diarrhea, bloating, and may actually lead to irritable bowel or inflammatory bowel disease in some people, is my understanding, and probably in cats as well. It also can, there's a degradation product of carrageenan that is a proven carcinogen. So most people, a lot of people know about that now, and they stay away from that as an emulsifier. I think it's still approved to be used in foods, but most of the high-end cat food companies don't use it anymore because people will stay away from it. It has been linked to, I think dietary carrageenan has never been directly linked to particular tumors, but because of this derivative, people stay away from it. It also can just cause some terrible gut aches. So if you have a cat who's got chronic vomiting or chronic diarrhea, absolutely stay away from the gums. It's hard to find food without any in it, but you can. I don't think that they generally cause allergies either. This is true, but we're looking at direct effect on the gut. And, you know, some cats, if they have diarrhea for long enough, they don't feel like eating. They have the association of feeling lousy with eating. And so make sure that you're looking at your labels. That goes back to the whole sodium thing. Compare different foods and make sure you're looking at your labels. You have to compare canned food to canned food and dry food to dry food because dry is so, you know, it's completely different as far as the amount of the percent of ingredients. But staying away from the gums as much as you can with cats is a good idea, my opinion.
And I'm just going to add one quick thing, and that is, I'm going to frame it as a question, but it's more, have you found that higher-end food, this is yes or no, is it worth spending the money on the better food?
I think it is, yes.
All right, perfect. And I'm only saying that because you end up with fewer problems all around. It's human, canine, whatever the species.
Exactly. So health-wise, it's worth it, but usually for your pocketbook, it's worth it as well.
And for this week, thank you very much, as always, Dr. Cannon. This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.